Week is Parshas Balak, or Balak, and Balak, he was the king of Moab, and he is in the war path of the Jewish people, and obviously he's not happy about the impending threat to his nation, so he does something very interesting. He hires a sorcerer slash necromancer slash prophet by the name of Bilam or Balaam to go curse the Jewish people. Now, essentially the entire parsha from beginning to end deals with this whole narrative where initially the first part is trying to convince, to recruit Bilam to go curse the Jewish people. And additionally, and then that takes a while because, you know, he goes and he asks God and God says no. And he says, well, let me go again. God says, well, no, but fine if you really insist you to go. And then on the way, he has this really bizarre encounter with his donkey. He has a conversation with his donkey, which is also very, very interesting, very bizarre. And then finally, they reach the Jewish people's encampment and they decide to go curse and they build the altars and prepare the animals and do the sacrifices. And God says, okay, you're not cursing, you're blessing. And then Bilam gives these magnificent blessings to the Jewish people, you know, instead of, in lieu of the intended cursing. And then, obviously, Balak, the guy who hired him, is furious. And he says, what's the deal? I hired you to curse, and now you gave him a blessing. So he just says, oh, let's try again. They go to a different mountaintop, and they try to bless, try to curse again. And God forces him to give another wonderful, fantastic, amazing, right, transcendental blessing. This happens a third time, but Bilam ends up giving four prophecies, and all of them are very remarkable, something we should probably examine if you have time to go through them one by one, because it seems like Bilam, in his prophecy, was able to capture the core of what makes the Jewish people special. Additionally, he also foretells things that, you know, in prophecy, that he is that's going to happen to Jewish people as well. Before we actually go into the individual particular aspects of the parsha, there's obviously a major question, and that is, you know, this Bilam guy, he's a prophet. Now, we tend to think of prophecy, or not we, but there is a tendency to think of prophecy as something like a lottery. It's like, oh, if I wake up tomorrow morning and says, oh, God spoke to me, you'll say, well, maybe he did. We never know, right? Right? If I told you last night I had a dream and God spoke to me and said X, Y, Z. What would you say? Well, maybe he did, you know. But the truth is that in Judaism, we don't believe in spiritual lotteries. You don't just have God come and talk to you out of the blue. Right? Prophecy is a stage of someone's development. Thus, if someone reaches the point where at their spiritual level, they're up to prophecy, well, they'll get prophecy. And if not, then they won't get prophecy. There are two exceptions to this rule. Exception number one is Bilam, and exception number two is the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. Those were times, for various reasons, where prophecy was doled out to people that were undeserving of it. And we learn, when you learn more about Bilam, the central character of this week's parsha, you actually find that he was decidedly undeserving of prophecy. You know, he was someone who was going out of his way to defy God. Despite his tremendous spiritual understanding of God, he was going out of his way to defy him. And he was going out of his way to try to sabotage the Jewish people. Ultimately, he injured the Jewish people, really badly, not via prophecy, but via advice that he gives to Balak. He actually, at the end of the parsha, he advises Balak to injure and harm the people by causing them to sin. He says, listen, I can't curse them. I can't use my prophetic powers to curse them. But let me tell you what to do. And he tells them, let's get the daughters of Moab, get them all to get dressed provocatively and go convince the Jewish people to sin. And once they're sinning, then you get them to commit adultery. And that's what happened. It was a terrible disaster. So he's a really bad guy. You know, why does someone like Bilaam buck the trend or buck the rule of who gets prophecy, someone who deserves prophecy? Why is it suddenly changed? This is a question that's asked in Jewish writings. I believe it's in the Talmud and probably the Midrash as well. Rashi brings it down. And it gives a very interesting answer. Listen to this answer. Why did Bilaam have prophecy? Because otherwise, the Gentiles would say, hey, if we had someone like Moses, we would become great like the Jewish people as well. Mm-hmm. Right? The reason why we didn't become great was because of we didn't have a leader like Moses. We didn't have a leader that had the prophecy like Moses. If we did, well, then we would become like the Jewish people as well. So God says, you know what? I'll give you a prophet who's equal to Moses in prophecy. How do we know he's equal to Moses in prophecy? Right? In Moses' epithet at the end of Deuteronomy, it says that there was no prophet in Israel like Moses. And it clearly implied is that there's no prophet in Israel like Moses. However, there are prophets amongst the nations that were as great as Moses. And who's that? That's referring to Bilaam. So Bilaam is someone, on one hand, he was given, not earned, but he was given tremendous levels of prophecy. But it was for a purpose, because it was to demonstrate that even if the Gentiles had the capacity of having a leader like Moses, well, they didn't actually fulfill that destiny, because he was actually, you know, he used his powers for negative purposes. So to me, it's an incredible analogy. We see like the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, so they all had prophecy. Was it prophecy that they deserved on their own? Did their actions and behavior and level of spiritual status, did that warrant they deserve prophecy? No. But they also had prophecy because for a specific reason, because Mount Sinai experience had to be done with national prophecy. But individually, each guy on his own didn't deserve prophecy. Moses deserved prophecy, Aaron, maybe a few other people, but not the masses, not the hundreds of thousands of people and kids and babies and old people and young people, men. Everyone got prophecy. Even the Egyptians that came to join the Jewish people, they got prophecy. Everyone, a wholesale prophecy. Prophecy for all.
When you say that they got prophecy, I mean they witnessed Hashem, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But then they received prophecy and they had that for the rest of their lives?
No, just for that experience.
Oh, just for that experience.
Okay. And by the way, they couldn't handle it. Like the Talmud says that they all died, had to be resuscitated. It proves it from the verses. Because if you're not a vessel that's worthy of having prophecy, you're not going to be able to survive. It's not you know we're not designed to have this interface with God. Mm-hmm. But these are two examples of, I would say, unearned greatness. And it's like I think we could give an analogy to someone who, you know, the guy who on one hand works really hard and earns his money. And the other guy who gets it, you know, delivered to him at his 16th birthday on a silver platter, you know? Who is more likely to use this in a positive way, to value it, right? To harness it, you know? And I think it's striking. We see, like, the best question that's ever been asked in all of human history. Well, it's a bit of a stretch, maybe, but... is how is it possible that the people, Jewish people, 40 days separated from Mount Sinai, from having national prophecy, they're getting their bread delivered to them in the form of manna, parachuted from heaven. They're drinking water out of a rock. How is it possible, a mere 40 days later, after having the most transcendental experience in all of human history, to go worship a golden calf and say, this is your God, O Israel, who took you out of Egypt? What the heck is going on here? How is that possible? It's a very good question. You know, there's a lot of answers given to the question. But I think this is a very good angle to approach it. Yes, they had prophecy in Mount Sinai, indeed. But that was a prophecy that was not a result of a life's work and effort and resistance to temptation and overcoming negative habits and perfecting character and achieving greatness in a whole array of areas of life. That was just granted to them, gifted to them.
But how could they have done all those things that you mentioned in slaves?
What do you mean?
You said that they didn't perfect their character traits, or they didn't.
I'm not blaming them.
I'm not saying that they egregiously didn't achieve prophecy, just like we egregiously didn't receive prophecy.
It's not.
They were who they were,
right.
And suddenly they get catapulted to a level that they're not deserving, based on the merit of their character alone. Therefore, I think room for an idea here, and that is that greatness that we earn, right, that is lasting, that is impactful, that is transformational. When we just have greatness given to us, and, you know, like I said, there's a parallel in the physical material world as well. But when we don't earn it, we don't value it. And we don't value it, it doesn't transform us either. And we see this with Bilam. Bilam, I guess there was a technical reason why he or someone like him had to have prophecy as a Gentile. The Jewish people, they had to receive prophecy, but they didn't actually earn it. And both of them, we see activities that don't seem to be at all in line with someone who had those accomplishments, had those intellectual accomplishments. And I think that there's really two steps to the conclusion. I think step number one is that, okay, if you don't earn it, well, it doesn't really change who you are. It doesn't make you a better person. You're still who you are, you know. It's like you could pull the Jewish people out of slavery, but it's harder to take the slavery mentality out of them, like that kind of line, you know. Or you could just foist greatness upon them, but then, you know, they're not actually great. I think that's one level of insight, but I think that perhaps there's even another level, and that is that not only is it not transformational, but it's possible to be a liability. It's possible to be deleterious, negative for you. It means, ironically, Bilam used his greatness for bad. Had he not had greatness, he would not necessarily have been bad. He specifically, as a result of his greatness, became even worse. And maybe, perhaps, the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, or some of the Jewish people who committed the sins of the golden calf, maybe they were too cocky, or, you know, too confident, or, you know, too haughty, or arrogant, or whatever, as a result of their prophecy, and that contributed to their downfall. Which is an insane idea. And in fact, there are some parallels to that. There's this idea in the Talmud. Talmud says that some people, if they merited the Torah, it becomes an elixir of life. Study Torah, and it becomes an elixir of life. Some people who are not meritorious, it becomes a potion of death, the Talmud says. Thus, it's possible. Now, what this actually means and how it plays out is a good question. But there is this idea of someone using Torah, most people using Torah, saying it becomes life for them. But some people, they use Torah and it becomes death. Well, how could Torah become death? You know. So maybe if it's not earned, maybe if it's not actually something that you achieve via activity as well. I mean, maybe there's another element here, that there's this distinction between what you know in your brain, your intellectual side, and your behavior and your activities.
Do you think maybe there's an element of sincerity that also might be missing there?
Absolutely.
You know, from the heart kind of sincerity.
Yes, yes.
I'm learning it,
yeah.
But...
But I think that there's a much, like, there's a broad idea that in all of Jewish... in all of Jewish philosophy, and that is that your insights have to translate themselves into actions. So it's possible that Bilam had tremendous insights into God and spirituality, but he didn't actually behave in a way that was a fulfillment of those understandings. And the Jewish people as well, remember, they had these tremendous miracles on Mount Sinai, yet they didn't have any Torah. Right? Moses is still up in the heavens. They don't have any way to actualize it. They don't have a way to have a personification, a manifestation of those insights. So it's just your brain is bamboozled with incredible understandings, intellectual and cognitive achievements, yet your body, your behavior, so to speak, doesn't actually match up to that. So then there's, you know, when there's this disparity between your behavior and your insight, typically your insight is going to contribute to the downfall of your behavior, because you have the arrogance, but it's, you know, or you have the perception of your own greatness, But it's unwarranted because you're actually not great because you are who you act, not necessarily what you know.
Can I ask a question here?
Go ahead.
Okay. Going back a couple of seconds ago, I was writing and I'm not sure I got the whole idea here. When you were talking about Bilam being given prophecy without deserving it, and you were talking about the reason for it, or one of the reasons for it, and you just said a minute ago that it may have been done because he didn't use the prophecy for good. But there was something else you said before that about that.
That reason
for why.
Yeah, because otherwise the Gentiles would have an excuse for their not achieving greatness. Because if we had someone like Moses. Either way, these are a bunch of different ideas to kind of think about Bilam and kind of understand his flow and his thought process. Because, yeah, like we said, we see someone with tremendous potential, tremendous greatness intellectually, but it's unearned, number one. Number two, it's not translated into action. And those things we have find parallels with the Jewish people as well. Mm-hmm. It's unearned greatness and it's not translated into action. And I think that, let's say for us, you know, it's important for us when we learn things. So we learn this book every Thursday. So a lot of lessons we learn. And those lessons, they go into our mind. And they potentially could also go into our behavior and transform us as an individual. Or they could just languish in our mind. And there's a dramatic difference between these two. You know, because if someone actually changes who they are and their behavior, then it's actually transformational. Then the Torah is the elixir of life. You know, then they're actually utilizing it for its end goal. It's actually influencing who they are. Otherwise, if it just languishes in your mind, it doesn't influence your behavior, well, ironically, you could be worse off, which is insane. Like, how could you be worse off studying Torah? Well, you could, because you're doing a partial job. You know, you're only letting it affect you intellectually, but not as a human being, right? In how you behave and how you live your life. And that's very dangerous. And that's when someone studies Torah but has no intention of fulfilling it. It's very dangerous because they're essentially utilizing the Torah for their own intellectual curiosity. It's like, oh, I want to know what the Torah says, but I don't want to actually, you know, have it. No. Like, there's a barrier between who I am and what I'm interested in, kind of intellectually. Because then you're essentially saying, I want the Torah, you know, to tantalize me intellectually. It's just there for me. I'm not actually taking its lessons to heart. What's actually interesting as kind of a follow-up for last week. We read about the red heifer. You know, and red heifer is entirely about action, not about insight at all. So it's actually a nice continuum where we see the polar opposites in back-to-back parshas. Last week we learned about the red heifer. When you do red heifer, like, you have no idea what you're doing. Your mind is not engaged at all. There's no insight that you could glean from it. It's just about action. And, you know, and that's one of the great mitzvahs that we have in the Torah. And here we meet, on this week's parsha, we meet Bilam, who it's all about insight and absolutely not about action. The exact opposite. And he is obviously one of the great villains in all of the Torah. And perhaps it's not a coincidence that this is his area of focus, and he doesn't look at last week's parsha. He doesn't say, oh, I want to behave in a way that is in line with these understandings, with these insights. Okay, so that's the parsha. That's essentially that's the entirety of the story.
Where is Bill from? Is he also from
Moab? He's from Midian, no? From Midian.
Balak is the
head of Moab. And Midian.
Hmm?
He's from Midian, I think. No, I'm not 100% sure on that, but I'm pretty sure he's from Midian. Midian and Moab and Balak, they all sound so similar. Okay, so let us start page 295. Susan, you want to start reading?
Okay. And it was in the morning that Balak took Bilam and brought him to the height of Baal, and from there he saw the edge of a nation. After Bilam arrived in Moab, Balak prepared him to curse Bnei Yisrael. And it was in the morning, and Balak took Bilam and brought him up to the heights of Baal, and there he saw the edge of a nation. Why did Balak feel the need to show Bilam the Jewish nation? Could Bilam have cursed them from the comfort of his office? The Rambam explains.
The Ramban explains. Almost spelled the same way.
Yes, and I shouldn't make that mistake. Sorry. The Ramban explains that Balak specifically led Bilam to a place where he would be able to see Bnei Yisrael with his own eyes, because a person is deeply affected by what he sees. Success of a curse depended on the impression that seeing Bnei Yisrael would make upon Bilam's heart. We find a similar phenomenon with Moshe Rabbeinu. When Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim
is Egypt in Hebrew.
Yeah. Amalek came out to greet them with sword in hand. Yehoshua gathered a group of men who would wage war, while Moshe went to the top of the mountain to daven for their success. There, too, the Ramban points out that Moshe specifically chose a spot from which he would be able to see those below, and they would be able to see him, because this would positively affect his prayers. True awareness is only achieved when a person sees something before his eyes. If one wants to truly feel the pain and suffering of a poor person, he should go to his house and view his dire living conditions.
There's a very interesting parallel in the beginning of Exodus. I believe it's chapter 2, verse 11. We meet Moses as a young man. The first verse says, then Moses grew up, and he went out, and he saw the suffering of his brethren, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. So it does say the word saw, and he saw, vayar, vayar, and he saw. And the Midrash points out that he saw the details, you know, and he let it absorb within himself what he saw. It's a very interesting parallel that our eyes are our conduits that give us the most information about the world around us. And if we want to be truly impacted, what we see is going to affect us more than anything else.
Even if we cannot see something with our eyes, we still have the ability to see it in our mind's eye. Picturing an event in our mind will affect us and enhance our momentum far more profoundly than merely reading about the event in a sefer.
Sefer is a book, a Jewish book, like a Hebrew, a Torah book. Go ahead.
Indeed, Hazal tell us that on the Seder night, we are supposed to see ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim. If we can recreate and depict in our minds the Exodus, then we can succeed in truly feeling as if we too left Mitzrayim. Rav Wolpe often quoted Kazari, who writes that imagination was given to us as a tool to conjure up pictures of our rich past, such as the Akita, Ma'amad, Hasinai,
these are the Akedahs, the binding of Isaac, Ma'amad Harsinai, which means the Mount Sinai revelation experience, and Beis HaMikdash, obviously, is a temple. So, imagination, we could conjure up images of our past, and that will help us.
Seeing something, whether with our eyes or in our minds, allows us to fully appreciate it.
Very, very interesting idea here. So he's actually using it kind of from the negative to the positive, that even negatively, like what you see negatively affects you as well, negatively. Like we see, if you have an intention to do evil, to do harm, well, your eyes are going to help you in that respect as well. But certainly in the positive as well, if whatever you see is going to impact you, like if you see, like you mentioned, the squalor of someone who's in pain or who's suffering, who's poor, it's very good to see it, because that could shake you up. On the other hand, there's this another idea here to supplement this idea, and that is that if you see something too often, you get desensitized, you get calloused to that imagery. So, for example, the Talmud says that when Herod refurbished the temple, the great king Herod, in the year 19 before the Common Era, began a multi-year process of refurbishing the temple. And he made it the most beautiful building in the world. In fact, the Talmud even goes to declare, if whoever didn't see Herod's temple, never saw a beautiful building in his life. It was just stunning. It describes, like, it had these waves of of blue marble and gold and whatnot, you know. And they instituted a law that when you walked into the temple, you walked in from one end, and then you left on the other end. But you didn't walk back through the entrance that you came through. Why? Because even something as magnificent and majestic as the temple, the most beautiful building in the world, if you saw it twice, you're ready, okay, I've seen it already. You know, I've been there before. And we want the people who come to the temple to be awestruck about the entire experience. So when they saw what they saw the first time, they didn't see it again, which I think is a very interesting kind of parallel to this, that yes, your eyes are incredible tools to give you, to galvanize you. Yet, if you see something too often, and if you just see it again and again, well, you don't lose, you get desensitized to it. I was thinking, like, you know, the people that are part of the Chevra Kadisha, you know, the people that are in charge are, that do the penultimate, the penultimate mitzvah of preparing a body for burial, even burying a body. And those people, like, if, you know, it's kind of creepy, you know, like you're dealing with dead bodies and burials and digging graves, and, you know, that's a very powerful, you know, like we say, you know, it's in the Book of Proverbs, it's better to go to a house of a funeral than to a house of joy, of celebration. Why? Because that's what changes you, you know? What makes you think about purpose of life more than contemplating the idea of death? Nothing. So yes, it's more fun to go to a joyous occasion, but what's more transformational? To go to something which is sad, you know, which is even tragic, because that makes us realize that we're not here forever. And thus, when we are here, our goal is to perfect ourselves and achieve that greatness that we can achieve. So that's why it's a very powerful thing. But if you happen to be someone who does this all day, every day, like, it doesn't impact you anymore. It doesn't, you know, if you're someone who's part of the burial society, you know, it's nothing, you know. It's just like, ironically, like if you're a surgeon, you know. You don't flinch at the idea of blood and cutting up people, and you know, it's you're a butcher, and that's a good thing, because if you weren't a butcher, you'd be too nervous to do surgery. You know, so there's a flip side to this as well, that yes, the imagery that we capture, and even we conjure in our minds is very powerful, but we can dull it, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Let's move on to the next one.
The enemy's praise. From the tops of rocks I perceive them, and from hills I see them, a nation that will dwell in solitude.
So this is part of Bilaam's blessings. And like we said, in his blessings, he doesn't curse him, and instead, three times, from three different mountaintops, he captures the essence of the nation. And it's, like we said, it's one of, like, the remarkable, like, for example, Matovo Alecha Yaakov, right? How good are your tents, Israel? It's part of our prayers. Well, who said them? Bilaam said them. Bilaam, the arch enemy of the Jewish people, he said them. Because at this time, he was under God's spell, so to speak, and God forced him to give tremendous blessings to the Jewish people. But this is one of the blessings that he talks about. From the tops of rocks, I perceive them. And from hills, I see them. It's very poetic as well, you know. Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, is that what that is?
But the Hebrew is Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, okay.
But Nebuchadnezzar, you've heard Nebuchadnezzar,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Okay, Nebuchadnezzar will testify that
Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah
refused to prostrate themselves before the idol, and so on. Here too, Hashem wants our enemies to testify to our righteousness.
By the way, the word that we've seen, chazal, everyone knows what chazal means?
No.
you've seen it already twice today,
yeah,
right? Chazal is an acronym, Hebrew acronym for Chachameinu Zichrono Levracha, which means our sages of blessed memory.
Oh. Ah.
So it's a usually a reference for any writing that is included in either the Mishnaic or Talmudic literature. Is Chazal is the acronym used to describe
that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a little insight. But it's, like I said, it stands for Chachameinu Zichrono Levracha, like of blessed memory. Our sages of blessed memory. But it's called Chazal. Go ahead.
David HaMelech says, "When those who would harm me rise up against me, my ears listen." Rav Yisrael Salantar commented that when an enemy speaks, we must listen. If our enemy says that we are righteous, we can be certain that we are truly righteous. However, if he says something negative, then we know we have fallen short of the ideal. As the pasuk says, when Hashem favors a man's ways, even his enemies will make peace with him. Hashem derives satisfaction, as it were, from the praises sung by our enemies, for there is no truer praise. How does Bilam describe Bnei Israel? From the tops of rocks I perceive them, and from hills I see them, a nation that will dwell in solitude. Rashi explains that Bilam looked into Bnei Israel's origins, patriarchs and matriarchs, and found that their foundation is rock solid. Every action of our forefathers was done with the intention of creating a spiritual nation, one that would dwell in solitude. We are to be so totally removed from the other nations that the Torah forbids us to even praise them or their possessions. Bilam perceived that the intention of the Avos
means the forefathers,
was to build a nation that would dwell in solitude. Even when living among other nations, we must bear in mind that Bilam's description is our very essence.
So essentially, he's bringing 2 points here in this section. Number one, the idea of what your enemy says about you is essentially what you are, because they're not partial. You know, they're not biased. They don't have, you know, they're not trying to mollify or assuage you. They're just saying it the way it is. Which is very interesting, because you wouldn't, like, you know, if you would think you want to learn about yourself, you would go to your friends or whatever. You go to your enemies, you'll get a more true picture of who you are, which is a very interesting idea.
Yeah, it is.
And it kind of it dovetails into the idea of the fact that, you know, we have biases. You know, we have distorted imagery of ourselves, which is obviously, it's not fun to hear about that, but I guess we do it maybe for psychological reasons. But either way, like, our own self-perception is not necessarily the best, not necessarily entirely accurate. And then not only that, our friends also won't have entirely accurate analyses of us, because they also, they feel like they're friends, they like us,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, you know, they're willing to forego a little bit of our shortcomings. Our enemies, that's where we go to find out who we really are, which is an incredible idea. Like, why would you go to your enemies?
Yeah.
They're your enemies, you know, because they are not at all influenced by any bias, and therefore they can actually give you the truth. So if your enemies sing your praise, you know you're in good shape. That's the first point that he brings. And the last point, kind of very quickly, he says that there's this idea of living in solitude, being a distinct nation. And if this is part of Bilam's prophecy, it's telling us that this is not just merely a characteristic of the Jewish people, but is a fundamental element of who we are. It's essential, crucial, pivotal, and fundamental to what the Jewish people are, is that they are a distinct nation. And we're in solitude. And I think, you know, we could talk about anti-Semitism a little bit, because I know a lot of people who explain anti-Semitism, you know, the illogical, over-the-top hatred of Jews, as being something which is inexplainable using traditional methods of trying to explain cause and effect. Rather, it's more of a spiritual idea and essentially a safety mechanism to ensure that the Jewish people remained a nation that would dwell in solitude. Because if we try to get too friendly with our neighbors, you know, if we try to settle down, get comfortable in our surroundings and we try to assimilate and become like everyone else, well, then they say, oh, no, no, you're not similar. You're different. And it's obviously not fun. It's not a fun part of being Jewish, but it's arguably a reason why we're still around. You know, right. our nation and our history is such an anomaly. It's you know, there hasn't been anything like it. A nation that's a very small number, always was, always will be, as the Torah says, yet is able to withstand so much expulsion, anti-Semitism, you know, exile, just persecution and Inquisition and Holocaust, and always rebuild themselves. You know, how is it possible? You get captured and you don't assimilate amongst the nation. You know, you get moved around, you get scattered, you don't assimilate. You maintain what you are, and you know, you uphold your traditions and you stay Jewish even in un-Jewish and unfriendly environments. You know, one of the reasons is that yes, we're distinct because we're different. And the Torah, you know, the Torah guides us to be different. You know, because we're different. We're Jews. The idea of a chosen nation means we have higher responsibilities than everyone else. But even from the flip side, it's as if the Almighty implanted in the non-Jews this reality as well, that we're different. And we're a distinct nation. We will dwell in solitude whether we like it or not, whether we accept upon ourselves that or not. Thus we have anti-Semitism, a phenomenon that spans millennia. It's as old as history can attest. That's right. Yeah, thank you.
We listened to it on the way to Austin last week.
Oh, great. I appreciate that. Okay, so maybe I'll read a little bit. And we can laugh at my pronunciations. Okay, and he turned his face toward the desert. So this is, also once again, part of Bilaam's prophecies and blessings. After Bilaam failed in his attempts to curse Bnei Yisrael, he hit upon another plan. Quote, and he turned his face toward the desert. Rashi quotes the Targum. Targum is Unculus, who explains that Bilaam's intention was to mention Bnei Yisrael's transgressions, thus causing Hashem to, quote, remember those transgressions. This would lay the groundwork for a curse to be successfully placed on Bnei Yisrael. Therefore, he turned his face toward the desert. He mentioned the desert, the place where Bnei Yisrael worshipped the golden calf. We find a similar concept in the Torah's discussion of the laws of the Sota. Sota is a woman being indicted on adultery. Or there's a claim that she was an adulteress. The Torah refers to the Sota's offering as a maskeras avon, a remembrance of her sin. If she is guilty, her sin is remembered, and the Sota waters enter her body and wreaks havoc on it. So there's this idea of remembering sin. Okay, let's learn more about this. Remembering a sin can be dangerous for another reason, too. Great scholars have asserted that when a person recites Vidu, Vidu means confession, on Yom Kippur, he should not spend too much time thinking about each individual sin. If he begins reliving his transgression, he might, God forbid, think to himself, even subconsciously, that he actually enjoyed what he did. In such a situation, remembering the sin will cause him to desire it again, and the Vidu will turn into a cause for punishment. When a person distances himself from his transgression to the point where his thoughts of the avera, sin, he committed do not even cross his mind, he can rest assured that he has been forgiven for that aver, for that sin. In a similar vein, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot tells us that it is good for a person to busy himself with both Torah and Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz means the way of life. For together they cause sin to be forgotten. You know, what does someone do if someone is just overwhelmed with sin? Well, you know what? Do other things. Like Torah study, or I don't know, swinging a hammer on a construction site. Just don't dwell upon the sin. You know, there's this idea of avoiding sin by forgetting about it. Although David HaMelech declares, "My sin is before me at all times," one must be on an extremely high spiritual level to be able to continually remember his sins. Even such a person should probably not be constantly thinking about his sins. Rather, the pasuk is teaching us that one should be careful at all times to avoid the type of situation that brought him to sin in the first place. Proper tshuva, tshuva means repentance, for a transgression should not include a detailed analysis of the sin, for the more one thinks about his sin, the more susceptible he becomes to repeating his mistake. Very, very interesting. You would think that, like, oh, confess, oh sinner.
Yeah.
You know, just think about it and dwell upon it. And no, that's not what we do, because that's counterproductive. You know, you think about it and you reimagine it and you bring it back up, and then you're more likely to transgress it again in the future. The proper attitude for that would be to just know, to avoid it, to not think about it, to not dwell upon it, and thus to actually move on from it. Wow, I think we might be able to finish all of them today. Susie, you want to start again the next one?
Okay. And Israel cleaved to the idol Baal Peor?
Yes.
Did I say that correctly? Okay. Idol worship in general is difficult to understand. Excuse me. Although we can comprehend how people might attribute godly characteristics to celestial bodies like the sun, moon, and stars, we cannot fathom what they hoped to gain by prostrating themselves before a slab of wood. The worship of the Baal Peor idol is particularly baffling. Rashi explains that the worshippers would expose themselves and defecate before the idol. What could possibly be the logic or philosophy behind such worship? Rav Yitzhak Huttner explained that this ideology is a manifestation of pessimism. It was the worshippers' way of declaring that the actions have no real purpose. At the end of the day, everything is worthless. When one eats a succulent steak or a gorgeous red apple, the end result is that everything turns into excrement. Such an outlook is diametrically opposed to the Torah. The Torah teaches us that every action has the ability to build, and nothing goes to waste. Even excrement can be used as fertilizer, as it contains essential life-giving nutrients that help develop a new crop. Everything in this world has a purpose, and nothing is wasted or totally lost. Do you want me to continue?
No. We have another volunteer.
Bilam declared, "Who can count the dust of Yaakov?" Rashi explains that there is no limit to the mitzvahs that Bnei Yisrael perform with earth. We are prohibited from plowing a field with an ox and a donkey yoked together, and from planting mixtures of seeds. We are commanded to use the ashes of the red heifer to purify those who came in contact with a dead person. And the test of the sota was performed with a mixture that contained earth. Bnei Yisrael are able to elevate even something as lowly as dirt. By using it to perform mitzvahs, attain purity, and restore harmony to the home of the Sota. This concept is discussed by Mesilas Yesharim.
Mesilas Yesharim is the path of the just.
That Kedusha is the ability to transform the mundane into the spiritual. Hazal tell us that giving food and drink to a Talmid Chacham is tantamount to offering a sacrifice and a wine libation, because Talmud Chacham channels every action towards spirituality. Indeed, the Mishnah refers to the Talmud Chacham as Bananim, builders, because they are the true builders of the world.
So this, I think, is an incredible, incredible little piece here. We'll start with the last thing here. So, like Kedusha, like the idea of taking even dirt, which is obviously the most ubiquitous and least sensational material out there, but you know, even this, which is the most lowly and mundane of materials, that is what even that we, the Jews, are able to elevate into spirituality. You know, and like, you know, you talk about the idea of making a blessing on a food, right? So you drink coffee, make a blessing beforehand. Or you eat food, you eat breakfast, and you make a blessing. And the question is, you know, everyone eats breakfast. What's so remarkable that we have to kind of get God involved? Like, this is not a spiritual activity. This is breakfast. Everyone who doesn't eat breakfast, or like if you miss breakfast, you get a big lunch. It's not like something that's relegated for Jews alone. It's for everyone. Like, what's spiritual about it? And the answer is that yes, indeed. Breakfast usually isn't spiritual for most people, But the Jewish insight, the Jewish innovation is that we take things that are on their own not spiritually valuable, and we make them spiritually valuable. We, you know, you're able to just transmogrify something from being mundane into being something very special. You know, that's an incredible insight. It's incredible power. But that is where our, perhaps our chief innovation lies, and that, and the idea of you know, even on a more intimate level, like on our body, right? Our body is a body. You know, if you to isolate the body and get rid of the soul, our body is no different than an animal. You have urges, you have whims, you have desires, you have instincts. And how is it different than an animal? It's not. The reason why we're different than an animal is because we have a soul. Our soul gives us the intelligence, and our soul gives us the purpose in life. But the goal is to create harmony between our body and soul by uplifting our body. In an exact parallel, the body on its own indeed is, yeah, it's a cup of coffee, it's a breakfast, it is what it is. Everyone has a body. Every human has a body. By definition, right? If you're a human, you're a body and soul. So what's so special about our body? We do so many mitzvahs with our body. We bind fill into our body, and you know, our body, put the whole body in the mikvah, and our body is the one who you know, eats the food on Shabbat, and you know, our body is a tool we use for all mitzvahs. You know, where there are some mitzvahs that are also in our mind, of course, but primarily most mitzvahs are with the body, because that is exactly the goal. The goal is the body, because the body is the area where the work needs to be done. The soul starts off being perfect, and then the soul hopefully will remain perfect as well. But the soul's job is to influence the body and to uplift it and to make it great as well, which is an incredibly, I think, transformative insight. And we point out, you know, even dust, you know, obviously other things as well. You know, what's the difference between an apple and an apple? Nothing. They're both apples, right? But if you make a blessing on it, you're taking this apple and making it spiritual, making it eternal, making it valuable forever, making it something that's going to be a ticket for you to eternal greatness. On the other hand, if you don't do that, well, then it's another apple. And you know what? If you take it to a lab and you measure the apple and you try to get some data on it, they're exactly the same. Of course, like we said, spiritual things cannot be quantified in physical terms. But when you do that, you actually transform it. You know, just like I would say, you know, when you study your Torah, you study Torah in your brain. So your brain is churning. Your brain can be churning, and it can be churning because you're dealing with a complex chess game or mathematical equation. Or your brain can be churning because you're studying Torah. Both cases, your brain's churning. One of them, it's a spiritual activity, and one of them, it's a physical activity. Physical, I mean, relating to the physical material, to the non-eternal. So that, I think, are very, very powerful ideas. Let's just recount the ideas that we had till now. Number one, we mentioned the idea of seeing and how important that is and how that could really galvanize someone towards action. Number two and three were the ideas of we are biased towards ourselves. Our enemies are not. Therefore, they may have the keenest insight into who we actually are. Number three, we said the idea of the Jewish people being a nation that dwells in solitude. That's the hallmark of the Jewish nation. And sometimes they may be foisted upon us against our will, and that's not always the most comfortable thing in the world. Number four is the idea of forgetting our sin, not dwelling upon it. That's not a very healthy attitude, and it's actually kind of productive. Number five and six are the ideas of nothing in Judaism goes to waste. We don't believe that things are nothing. Things are everything. Your actions are real and meaningful and impactful and eternal. And lastly, we saw the idea of Kedusha, the idea of uplifting the mundane and making the physical, the material, transforming it into being eternal and everlasting. And I say also, additionally, like there's a theme throughout the whole Parsha that is, you know, if you zoom out a little bit and you look at the details of what Bilaam did and who he was and what he was trying to do, you find very clearly that Bilaam is the bad guy. He's a bad guy. And even though he has so much reason to be great. And perhaps, like we mentioned at the beginning, perhaps it's because it's unearned. And therefore, when it's unearned greatness, it's not going to change who you are. That's one idea. Or it's a greatness that's not translated into action. Whatever we know, we have to implement. If we don't implement it, it just languishes in our brain, well, then it could be really bad, like in the case of Bilam. Those are some nice ideas. Once again, fantastic. We'll see you guys next week. My brother will be back. And I'm sure he's looking forward and eager to take over the reins again. And this was wonderful. And we have a wonderful Shabbos.
Yeah.